Universität Freiburg, and he will talk on affine geometry of degeneration limits and mirror symmetry.
Okay, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me and giving me the occasion to talk. And probably at this time of the day, at the fourth day of the conference, I need to be very energetic to keep you awake, especially if the light is as dim as it is. So I hope it's I can be energetic enough to keep you awake. So my talk will consist of two parts. And the first part, I will be just we just give a an overview of my joint work with Mark Gross, mirror symmetry via log degeneration data. And in the second part, I want to illustrate this general philosophy we have by an application to counting holomorphic curves via tropical curves. Okay, so let me start with a general overview. And in preparing this talk, I went back and thought how long I'm actually working with Mark on this. And I think Mark gave wrong figures. It's 4 years old, actually, that we started doing this. So it started in 2000 when we had the first ideas on this. And essentially, to 2002, we developed the basic framework of this, and then it took another year to actually finish the technical details for the paper, and since then we are trying to flesh out the program. And it's our program is motivated, has motivations from two sources. And most of you know Mark Gross for a long time, and it seems obvious that there is some motivation from this Strominger-Yau-Zaslow program. But I would also like to emphasize that there is motivation also from log geometry. And the link between these two things were not clear at the beginning. And actually, I was working with about degenerations of varieties with Stefan Schröer. And he introduced me to log geometry. So Stefan Schröer introduced me to log geometry. And this is actually when we had the first ideas on using this. And so log geometry is a very strange thing. And at first, I didn't like it at all because it seemed very technical. And but over time, I got convinced that it's actually a very useful tool. So this was introduced by Fontaine, Elusi, and Katsuya Kato. So these are the two motivations for our program. And it's because I think I should emphasize, because most of you are probably very familiar with the SYZ program, and the perception of our work is probably biased to the contribution to the SYZ program, but I want to emphasize that this is only half of the story. And especially, one major difference to the SYZ program is there's no real role of a Ricci flat metric in our in our program. There are some remainders of a matrix that are very vital for mirror symmetry, but Ricci flatness I don't think has anything to do with mirror symmetry, just from our program. So in particular, special Lagrangians don't seem to be actually important. Lagrangians are important, and certain Lagrangians, but the special condition I don't think, while interesting and beautiful geometry, I don't think is actually vital to mirror symmetry. And the second thing is, but you could maybe argue about this. I think we have a very clean separation of the two sides in mirror symmetry, so of the complex and the symplectic sides. So you see, once you start talking about special Lagrangian vibrations, you immediately bring in both sides. Then you can say, okay, let's forget one side, let's forget it's complex, and let's just talk about Lagrangian vibrations, or let's forget about the other side, but then you don't really know how to fill in the other side. And there are actually some surprises in these separations of the complex and symplectic side that I will comment later on. So data that you believe should belong to the symplectic side show up on the other side and vice versa. But we will see. And the other thing is, and this is of course the main point of the whole program, I think it's technically much simpler. And more more applicable and computable. So what is the basic picture? So we do not start from a special Lagrangian vibration because then we would need to, or from a Lagrangian vibration because then we would need to say how we get these. But rather we start from so-called toric degenerations. I will give a definition of what a toric degeneration is in a minute. So it's a certain degeneration of algebraic varieties, where the central fiber is a union of toric varieties. And once you have a toric degeneration, that contains too much information, information that are not really interested in. But we can forget about large pieces of this, and this is where log geometry comes in. So we essentially keep just the central fiber with a little bit of additional information. So how did I want to say this? So the log degeneration data. And sometimes you can go back, either by elementary means, or Mark showed you how to go back for the case of K3 surfaces. So by elementary means, I mean, for example, for degenerations of abelian varieties, you can easily construct global toric degenerations from these degeneration data. That's work that has been around for a long time and work on degenerations of abelian varieties. And actually, that was also motivation for our program. But then the main point is that the logarithmic degeneration data is actually equivalent to certain affine data. And this only is where the relation to the SYZ program becomes apparent, as we have seen at many occasions in this conference already. How the base of an SYZ vibration is actually does carry actually two affine structures that are related by a Legendre transform. And now the essential observation is this is where we do have our mirror symmetry. So here we have this discrete Legendre transform. And this is where mirror symmetry takes place. So in particular, mirror symmetry is not something that that relates smooth Calabi-Yaus or anything, but we are talking about certain residual information for degenerations of Calabi-Yaus that are mirror dual. Okay, and in this way, we do have at the very moment a Veloc framework for the explanation of mirror symmetry. But let me just so let me comment on the status of the whole project. So this is the basic, all these arrows here, this is the basic content of my paper with Mark that came out last year and had the remarkable length of 144 pages. But it's so the status, then people ask me, I mean, this is number one of your program, so how many more pages are you going to write? And so the answer is, it depends what you want. And I think so as I said, I'm totally happy with this explanation of mirror symmetry, but to be entirely sure that this is a good explanation, we want some deeper tests. So the question then is, can we actually apply this philosophy to like these advanced calculations of Gromov-Witten invariants versus variations of Hodge structures? And once I see this, I'm ready to say, okay, this is our program is finished in a sense. Okay, so this is the status. Verify by deeper implications. Okay, so now let's. Maybe one philosophical remark is, what is the effect of all these degeneration things? And I think that's something that is also it's a basic technique in physics that you kind of break up things into simpler pieces. So what is happening is, you see, the basic effect of this whole degeneration stuff is that we break up our Calabi-Yau, which is too complicated, to nonlinear, into simpler pieces. And the simpler pieces are toric pieces. And of course, they still need to have some relation, and this is a log structure, which is, again, toric in nature. Okay, so now I want to, this was some introduction, and now I want to give you, explain you a little bit more about these technical terms like toric degenerations, log degeneration data, well, affine data I can almost spare because you have already heard a lot about this. So let me give a technical definition here. What's a toric degeneration? So a toric degeneration is first a holomorphic map to, let's say, the unit disk. Such that the following properties hold. So first, this should be a degeneration in the traditional way of complete varieties. So that means, so they will want P to be proper and flat, and we want the norm, the total space to be normal, and the central fiber to be reduced. Okay, so the second condition is, and I mentioned this already, that the central fiber is a union of toric varieties. Complete toric varieties, of course. And, well, it's not just any union, but we want to glue these toric pieces in a toric way. So these are toric varieties, and here I want to not do it too technically. I just say glued along toric divisors. Toric divisors. So a standard example is you take a degeneration of a quartic into a union of quartic in P3 into a union of four hyperplanes. Then you get four pieces of P2. On each P2, you have three lines. And you glue these lines such that the whole thing gives the shape of a tetrahedron. So you have four copies of these pictures, and then you glue the whole thing so that altogether you get something like the shape of a polyhedron. So that's one of these examples of the central fibers that we are actually interested in. And the third condition, which in a sense is mirror dual to the second condition, as you will see, is that this map is also locally toric. And, well, away from some bad locus of higher codimension. So there is a subvariety, a subset, Z and X, closed subset of codimension at least 2, such that phi restricted to the complement is locally toric. And by this, I mean it's here, or maybe not. I need a little more space. Well, it's codimension 2. What is this? You mean the complement x minus z to map to what? No. Well, right. As, yes. I'm not finished with point 3. Okay, so locally this means it looks like the following map, given there's nothing to put this. Raise up. Given by a map CT to CP, where P is a toric monoid, T maps to a monomial, toric Gorenstein monoid. So you usually write this as P is sigma dual intersect with a lattice in toric geometry. And one essential point is that rho should actually be in the interior of the sigma dual. So we also want that rho is in the interior of sigma dual. That's an essential requirement for being locally toric. Well, and then I should add here, as Mark reminded me, so Z does not contain toric strata. And yeah. Okay, so examples are, of course, like generalizations of the, well, first, of course, any semi-stable degeneration. So in this case, you would just take Z, the empty set, is always locally toric, and then P would be, well, some copies of N to K, maybe some additional factors, and then the row would be the first entry is 1, and then you have 0. So this corresponds to mapping T, the product of the first K coordinates. That's a normal crossing degeneration. And then more interestingly, and this is the case in these, if you apply this program to the to Butterer's construction of mirror pairs in toric varieties, hypersurfaces in toric varieties, so whenever you have something of the following form, TF plus chi to rho equals 0, and this sits inside certain toric varieties. So F would be any general polynomial of the same degree as rho. So this would be in a certain toric variety, X sigma, and then you have D, and you take the projection to D. And in this case, Z, I think this was also in Victor Batrev's talk, or also David Morrison's talk, Z would be the intersection of the singular locus of chi to rho equals 0 with the zero locus of F, and then cross D. So this would be F equals 0, intersected single locus of chi to rho equals 0, and then cross D. And this has codimension, relative codimension 2. Three lines to one point in the base. Yes. I didn't get it. Elliptic curve, a degeneration of elliptic. Yeah, sure, that's possible. You can. Okay, so maybe I should save some space for this picture. So I think I explained a little bit what the toric degeneration is, and then how do we get log degeneration data off of this. So this will be the next point. It's not, I mean, I tend to escape from this issue in talks, but I think it's a very important thing, and as you're a tough audience, you might as well swallow it. So what are log degeneration data? So I have to say what a log space is. By definition, a log space, or a log scheme maybe, so it's first, let's say a scheme X, together with a sheaf of monoids. And usually written multiplicatively. Well, I want to write it multiplicatively of monoids. Traditional computation MX. So monoid was just actually commutative monoids. Was just set with an associative law with units, but you don't have inverses. So of commutative monoids, MX, together with a homomorphism of sheaves of monoids. Alpha, well, from MX to the non-zero elements, sheaf of non-zero functions on X, and together with, to OX, S a monoid with multiplication. Okay, and the only condition is that we get an identification of the subsheaf of invertible functions with the preimage here. So alpha restricted to alpha inverse of OX star induces isomorphism alpha inverse OX star nach OX star. Okay, so of course, if you see this the first time, I don't expect you to actually get it. It took me several months. So what's the purpose of this? But I think it's good to just think of one example. If you understand one example, I think you understand essentially what's going on in log geometry. And the essential example is the following. You take a divisor. If you want, think of a normal crossing divisor, but this is not essential for the construction. And then you define MX. Let me call it MX, D, because it's a universal construction for any divisor, as functions that take zeros only along D. So I could write this as OX minus D cross intersected OX. Okay, so these are regular functions, and away from D, they have no zeros. And then I take the alpha homomorphism, just the inclusion into OX. Obviously, this is a sheaf of monoids. This is a homomorphism, and this is an example of a log structure, and the most important example. So if you apply this. I mean, there was a more traditional version of log geometry that probably most of you know is for a divisor with normal crossings. So this occurs if you write down something like the sheaf of holomorphic functions with logarithmic poles. And then you apply this for a normal crossings divisor. But you can be more general. And in particular, you can apply this for any toric variety, and D is the boundary divisor of the toric variety. So most useful axis spec C of sigma dual cav M. Let's call this maybe P as before. And then you see that this M reflects the properties of B of P. So if you have over a stratum given by a certain phase of P, then correspondingly you can this gets reflected in this M being more complicated. So maybe just one example. So what are the stalks of this M? If you look, let's say X is just A2 and D is X Y equals 0. So what are the stalks of M? Well, away from the divisor it's just O cross. And then along these codimension one things, along the codimension one strata, well, what do you have? I mean, you have a vanishing order. You still want regular functions. So any function here has a vanishing order along this divisor. And if two functions have the same vanishing order, they differ by an invertible function. So the stalk actually looks like a direct sum, or it cross direct sum n, and n gives the vanishing order. Same thing here with a different n, so to speak. And here you have vanishing orders on both components, so you get always cross direct sum n squared. And the two generalization maps are projection to the first coordinate or projection to the second coordinate. Okay, so the point of this is, why do we want to do abstract log geometry instead of working with toric varieties or patches of toric varieties? Well, the point is you can restrict log structures. So you don't actually need an ambient space. For example, and this is the kind of log structures we will deal with. So here you have the central fiber sitting in your degeneration x over d. And then this sits over 0 in d. And so you get a log structure, m. M total space comma central fiber, and you can restrict it to the central fiber. Okay, and this is what I call MX. And then you can believe that you get the same thing down here. And if you do this, well, that's just a point, right? But still, it's a non-trivial log structure. So MD comma 0, because you have vanishing orders restricted to x. So what? Zero. So actually, this is just this is a skyscraper, of course, just a point. But this looks like C star direct sum n. Okay, and this is what is called the standard log point. Okay, the point with this kind of log structure, and I'm not writing down the alpha homomorphism that's easy to as an exercise, but this gives a standard log point. And then, of course, because this all comes from such a commutative diagram, you have a morphism of log spaces of the central fiber with this log structure to this standard log point. And that's the kind of logarithmic degeneration data I want. Okay. Now, why do we do this? Now we have a log structure, but what do we win by doing this? To this thing? Well, it looks the same, except that you don't write OX star, but OD. Okay. Well, beware, it doesn't always split, right? I mean, this is just point-wise and so on. I mean, you have to be careful. It's not as trivial, maybe, as it seems. Well, the good thing about log geometry is that with these spaces, so for example, think of a normal crossings degeneration, then this is, in some sense, a very unpleasant space. So for example, try to compute something like the differential forms that even has torsion and so on. But here, with this log in the framework of log geometry, all these things look exactly the same as if they were smooth. So essentially, the philosophy is whatever you can do in the smooth category, once you introduce log structures to these kind of degenerations, you can work as if the whole family was smooth. And that's a big technical advantage, of course. So there's a notion of smoothness in log geometry. And actually, if Z is empty, let's say, then this morphism you get of log spaces XMX to the standard log point, so this is zero, M0. This is smooth in the logarithmic sense. Away from Z, okay? And of course, that's very useful. So for example, you expect And that's known in many cases, for example, in normal crossings cases, that you can compute the log, the Hodge numbers of a general fiber by looking at the logarithmic Hodge numbers of the central fiber. So there's lots of information on the degeneration that is just kept in, that is contained in the log structure. Okay, and this is exactly where mirror symmetry takes place. Sorry? Z is unpleasant from a logarithmic point of view. Z. Oh, you couldn't read this, I saw. It's small, right? Okay, so then the last piece of information is this affine data. Now there's a little more than what we have seen so far. It's not just an affine manifold. First, we have two kinds of affine data, just as in the SYZ program. And we call these two kinds the fan picture and the cone picture. Well, in the fan picture, you get charts for the affine structure by looking at the fans defining the irreducible components of the central fiber. Okay, and then they patch them together. In the cone picture, you need a polarization, so an ample line bundle, and then if you have this, you know there is a polarized toric variety corresponds to a polytope. And so each irreducible component actually gives a polytope, and then you patch these together. So the fan picture, this manifold B that we constructed, has a cell decomposition, which is the dual cell decomposition. It's a dual intersection complex of the central fiber. So topologically, supports dual intersection complex. So this means for each irreducible component, you take a vertex. Whenever they intersect, you draw an edge, and so on. And so the points would actually correspond to the irreducible components, while the top-dimensional cells correspond to kind of deepest singular points of X. And this gives an affine. Here's a section, right? So this has an affine structure. So I'm not going to explain exactly how we get this, but this has an affine structure away from co-dimension 2, single locus. And this is like in the K3 surface case, these were the singular points of the affine structure that Mark drew the other day. And the other picture, you just remove the word dual. So it's the same thing, but you remove the word dual, so it's an intersection complex, and you get similarly an affine structure. But you also need a polarization for the cone picture. Okay, and I would like to call this B check. Okay, and then we have delta check in B check. It's also co-dimension. Topologically, okay, so the dual intersection complex gives a topological space. And that's what I mean. So B is this space topologically. And then I endow it with an affine structure. Yes, definitely. Yes, we have complete control over these singularities and so on. Okay, so in the K3 surface case, we had these, well, for certain cases, okay, I need to impose one more technical condition. So saying that corresponds to the fact that we get only these I1 singular fibers for this corresponding fibration, but then it was just the standard singularities of affine structures in dimension 2. In higher dimensions, we have local models. Okay, so in the SYZ picture, this was the fan picture. So the fan picture, you should think the fan picture is a limiting version of SYZ of the complex side. Limiting phase of SYZ fibration on complex side. So the complex side that involved the choice of a holomorphic end form. And the cone picture correspondingly would be the limiting version of the SYZ fibration on the symplectic side. So this is where you get the affine structure by integrating the symplectic form along one cycles. Okay, so and we have a polyhedral decomposition. Okay, so this is BP, and this is B check P check. And of course, this is a polyhedral decomposition. Okay, and of course, the polyhedral decompositions on both sides are combinatorially dual decompositions. Okay, so but there is a little more for the fan picture. So for the complex side, we don't only have B and P, but we also need a cohomology class. So this is information that is needed to actually recover the log space X with the log structure MX. So H1 I lost a lambda tensor over Z with C star. This is needed to make this a 1-1 correspondence with the corresponding log space on the mirror data on the symplectic side, so the cone picture side, is then, well, B check, P check, and then the dual information would be I check lower star lambda tensor Z C star, same group, but on the other affine with respect to the other affine structure. Okay, so then the theorem that we proved in this long paper is that under an additional assumption, which essentially says that the degeneration that you take is deep enough. So this corresponds to a maximal unipotency condition of the monodromy. We have the following 1-1 correspondence. So the x mx, together with this morphism to the standard log point, 0, m0, mod isomorphism. Well, and with the given, inducing the given affine data, of course. Log Calabi-Yau. So there's a Calabi-Yau condition coming in that I haven't mentioned so far. Is the same as this data. So a set of such affines, this manifold BP and C. And okay, so and this holds only under this simplicity assumption. And the simplicity assumption says, for example, that the monodromies around any of the legs of the discriminant logs are actually indivisible, are primitive. So this would correspond to the fact that the degeneration, if you apply this program to the degeneration, is deep enough. Okay, so then, now what's the whole perspective of these things? Well, I could now make a long list of tasks that we actually, in the long run, should do, but that I alone or together with Mark can possibly not fulfill in a lifetime. It's just that whatever has been invented in this context within the last 10 or so years should be expressed into affine data. So whatever, I mean, this affine data contains virtually the whole information about this family of Calabi-Yaus. So whatever you know about Calabi-Yaus, be it Gromov-Witten invariants, or A-infinity categories, or Gopakuma-Wafa invariants, or whatever, because it's contained in the, all the information is contained in the FN data, there must be some expression in terms of FN data. And we are just at the beginning in understanding what, how do we express these things on this affine side. So, so the task is expressed in terms of BPC, and then maybe the C and whatever other data you need. Well, any data you know for Calabi-Yaus. So, for example, from Witten invariants, Kaya category. The topology any topological data, the variations of Hodge structures, the limiting Hodge structure of course, and Donaldson-Thomas invariant, Gopakuma-Wafa, and so on and so on. So what, as I said, is I'd be completely happy, and I think that's the true Lachmus test, at least for me, for any version of mirror symmetry program. Can we reproduce these old and maybe still most amazing computations of the Gromov-Witten invariant, let's say of the quintic, in terms of variations of Hodge structures? So in particular, verify Gromov-Witten variations of Hodge structures. Oh, actually, maybe there was many people here are interested, seem to be interested in arithmetic questions. And there's been I had some really nice discussions with Jan Steenstra the last few days. And I think there is also some meaning, don't ask me how exactly, but there must be some meaning of arithmetic properties of these Calabi-Yaus in terms of these affine structures. But this is really very, very much unfounded. Okay. So then this second part of the talk, where I don't have too much time, I want to illustrate this this whole big machinery at one very simple example, and this relates to Mikalkin's talk, and how do we see tropical curves, how do tropical curves count Gromov-Witten invariance? Or how do they, it's actually not Gromov-Witten invariance really, but it's how do tropical curves count holomorphic curves? So, okay, so I start with some fan in NR, and actually NR is just all B in the fan picture. It's a trivial version of the fan picture. It's just one fan. And then the theorem that I proved with Takio Nishino, who is also here, is that we have two counts. So one is on this toric variety, X sigma, and then, well, I need to specify data, okay, that I'm going to explain in a second. Once it's an algebraic, it's a count of algebraic curves, together with some incidence conditions, and the other side is a count of tropical curves with similar incidence conditions. So the left-hand side is a count of holomorphic curves. So this is a paper on the web, came out in September. So it's a count of holomorphic curves. Genus zero. Delta has to do with kind of the homology class. So I call this a degree. And the L are certain incidence conditions. So this gives actually a family of orbit closures of subgroups of the torus. And so you ask your holomorphic curves to actually intersect these orbit closures. And of course, you do it in such a way that the expected dimension is zero. And the right-hand side is a similar count for tropical curves in NR, count of tropical curves. I can use the same notation. So genus zero, there's a notion of genus for tropical curves. Degree delta, you have incidences. But the difference is here you actually need weights. The weighted count. Well, this is the true number of curves. And I should point out these are not Gromov-Witten invariants except in the case when we are in a Fano situation. What it is more, so these are in particular not symplectic invariants, but it's somehow, I think of this as relative Gromov-Witten invariance, relative for the toric variety, relative to the boundary divisor. And so let me just give a glimpse of how this correspondence works. And of course, it works in three steps. So the first thing is, there are polyhedral decomposition. I can produce degenerations of toric varieties by using polyhedral decompositions of NR. So these produce toric degenerations. And the correspondence is actually very simple. So this is one of the cases where you can actually go back from logarithmic degeneration data or from affine data to true families. The second step is, well, how do we get, if we have then a correspondingly degenerating family of holomorphic curves, how do we get a tropical curve? And then the third thing is, how do we use logarithmic geometry to go back from tropical curves to holomorphic curves? So I'll try to be brief in the remaining 5 minutes to give you an idea of how these things work. So one is very simple. Most of you probably might have seen this. So you start with a polyhedral decomposition with an asymptotic fan. So it's a semi-infinite width. I haven't really said what P is, right? But here I need to extend the allowed polyhedral decomposition slightly. So here I allow semi-infinite polyhedral decomposition. And such decompositions have an asymptotic fan, as I will just draw in a second. So asymptotic fan sigma. So let's say sigma is, let's do a very simple example. Let's say sigma is a fan of CP2. And then the polyhedral decomposition I would allow, for example, is something like this. So the asymptotic fan just keeps like the asymptotic directions. And then if I have this, I can produce a degeneration with general fiber x sigma and the central fiber given by exactly the space, the log space x that we saw before on some other blackboard. So this gives the degeneration as follows. You define a fan sigma tilde by taking the cones over all the elements of the fan sigma. And then you take the closure also to make these closed cones for the semi-infinite stuff. So sigma is in sigma. So this is a fan in NR direction R, one dimension more. Okay? So obviously this has a map of fans to the fan of A1. Just by projecting to the last vector. So for example, if you start with, let's say just dimension one, then you have a polyhedral decomposition. It's just choice of some integral points. You put it in height one in R2. Here, zero is arbitrary somewhere. And then you take this corresponding cones, and this gives you a fan. And what I drew is actually a degeneration of P1 to a union of P1s. So, and this gives a toric degeneration, x sigma tilde over A1, and the central fiber is the union over, well, for each vertex here, you see you have a fan, right? Just by extending these rays to infinity. So this gives a fan sigma v. So if v is a vertex, then this gives a fan sigma v. And this is exactly the union of all these sigma v's. And the general fiber is x sigma. OK, so then the second thing, if you have a family, a stable map, a degenerating family of stable maps, let's say something like this, for any toric degeneration, actually. So this is a stable map. And I assume that it's transverse on the central fiber. So I assume that phi transverse on x, which is the central fiber. That means, by this I mean that the image of phi does not meet toric strata of codimension larger or equal one, larger or equal two. So image phi intersected with x, well, let's call these xc maybe, should be empty whenever the dimension of c wireless calls this way. CodeDimension XC is larger or equal to 2. And then I can define a topical curve, which is a subskeleton, a subcomplex of the one skeleton of this polyhedral decomposition, defining this degeneration. So you just take gamma as the union of all xi's, such that this image intersects xc. So this sits inside the corresponding fan picture manifold, and it's obviously a subcomplex of the one skeleton of P, so contained in one skeleton P. I spare the proof that it's actually a tropical curve. So one very important condition was this balancing condition, which Richard explained. And this just has to do with an intersection theoretic property of curves on a toric variety that are transverse to the boundary. So this is always the case. So just a few more lines and then we're done. So how do we get, this produces from degeneration families of holomorphic curves. Oh, I should say, transversality can always be achieved by refining the degeneration. And so we know how to get from the holomorphic curves to tropical curves. Conversely, if I have a tropical curve, well, I first show that actually I only need to deal with three-valent tropical curves. So there's some genericity argument for these incidence conditions. So we need only three-valent tropical curves. And then at any three-valent vertex, well, this is now a subcomplex of a one skeleton of the fan, of a fan, right? And then I just study, I can classify the holomorphic curves intersecting only the boundary, the toric boundary in exactly 3 points. And this is kind of generalized lines in a toric variety. So for each vertex, there's a space of lines. It's called V, space of lines sitting inside XV, given by this three-valent vertex. And it turns out that the torus acts simply transitively on these space of lines. So the C star to N, so it's a torsor on the C star to N, so acts simply transitively. So then if you go on to glue, now we glue our curve together by taking all these lines on each component given by the tropical curve, and then we have a matching condition. And of course, because this is a C star to N torsor, well, the matching condition that gives a point on the boundary divisor, that will fix a C star N minus 1. Okay, and then I need to organize the whole thing, and I see, well, it fits together if a certain map of lattices is actually I can solve a certain integral equation in these twists, and it turns out there exists exactly a certain lattice index worth of solutions. So I'm not going to write down this map of lattices. It's just if you write down carefully all these matching conditions, you get a certain number that can be arbitrarily high, actually, for one single tropical curve. So for one single tropical curve, I get a number, a discrete number of curves in the central fiber that are glued from lines. Okay? Now we are stuck, right? Usually we are stuck at this point. Now comes the log geometry. we want to do deformation theory to actually extend to the family. And so to do this, I first have to endow this glued thing, very singular, with a lock structure. So to deform, endow with lock structure. And again, there are more possibilities, but they are actually the product. You see, a tropical curve also had weights, right? And it's the product of the weights, many lock structures for each of these glued lines. And the sum of all these, of the product of these things, the lattice index and the product of weights, that gives the count N0 delta trop. Okay? So then the final point, it turns out in this case, the logarithmic deformations are unobstructed. And then at this point, of course, genus zero enters. Okay, so this is how it works for Fano varieties. And of course, then the question is, how do we do this for Calabi-Yau? Much of what I said works exactly the same. Except, and this is already a tropical issue, we don't have this genericity argument. And well, three bound should still be fine, but we might have higher dimensional deformations of even of these tropical curves, and then we need to study families and do virtual business, which I haven't worked out yet, but I'm quite hopeful to do so. Okay, thanks.
Are there any questions?
Down here? Say it again. See? What the degeneration? Locks. Yes. No, that was just an example. Where everything is very simple. No, it's much more general, of course. I mean, many spaces have toric degenerations. But I mean, these degenerations of toric varieties are also a case where there is no singular locus, right? We just have this Rn, no discriminant locus, and this corresponds to no z.